Good afternoon, KDNK fans. You are listening to Ask the Vet. This is Mary Fox. We're here with you every third Thursday of the month at 4:30. And today we're going to talk about new puppies and new kittens. And I have Dr. Chad Rober with me here today. Hello, Chad.
Hello there, Mary.
And remember, this is a call-in show, so please call us at 963-2976. Chad loves getting your calls. It's an opportunity to just ask any question you want about your pet, your neighbor's pet, your daughter or your son's pet, whatever. So, Chad, we're going to talk about puppies and kittens today. So I'll ask you an easy question first. Is there a cycle for when kittens and puppies are born, like livestock, like wild animals?
Good question. There's definitely a cycle for cats. Cats are what we call seasonally polyestrous. And what all that means is that their ovulation is tied to day length. So we will see a large number of kitty cats coming into heat, ready to be bred as the days get longer after the winter solstice. And so, consequently, we see a lot of kittens in the springtime. And cats are especially efficient at that. The term polyestrous means that they will continue to come into heat until they get bred. And so that's one of the reasons the cats are so efficient at having lots of kittens.
So if you miss a heat and they don't get pregnant, you didn't miss it.
They're going to come back again. And that's why we have way too many kittens in the world. Now, dogs are not the same. They are not as dependent at all on day length. So you can see puppies born pretty much year-round. So they're not as seasonal as the cats are.
About what age do dogs go into heat?
It would depend on the breed. If you have a little teeny dog, they can come into heat from about five and a half months on. A Great Dane may not hit puberty till they're a year and a half to 2 years of age. So very dependent on the size of the dog. Probably an average would be more like 8 to 9 months is where most dogs would come into heat.
So what we really want to focus on today, I think, is to talk about wellness and to talk about, you know, how do you, if you decide you want to have a puppy, whether you've had one before or not, but especially if it's new to you or a kitten, what are the things that you are most important for you to think about in order to raise this really healthy animal?
Well, I think one of the things veterinarians would love to be involved in more is the choice of what kind of dog you're going to get. We see a lot of cases where there is a mismatch between what the person thinks they want and the living situation they're in, or the ability to get outside and all that sort of thing. So here in Western Colorado, you know, it's the dream to have the dog that you can take on a run and you can go hiking with, and that's great. But you got to be really honest with yourself: is do you have that kind of time? Do you have a house that is large enough for a large breed active dog? So, if I had to start with that question, I would say, let's have a little discussion about what really makes sense for your situation. We get stuck a lot of times trying to deal with some behavior problems that were actually just a mismatch from the start. So, you know, talk to people in the know, your veterinarian, people that have been around dogs a long time. Make sure that you are choosing a breed that fits your lifestyle. Kitty cats, that's not quite the same. We don't really behavior test cats as much. But once again, think about what is best for your lifestyle. Maybe a cat is better for your lifestyle if you don't have a lot of room, or if you don't want to have to take care of taking a dog for a walk two or three times a day. So a lot of planning before you actually make the move would be one of my first recommendations.
What are some of the, I'm going to start with dogs and then I'll move to kitties, but what are some of the things that show up if you don't plan this well. In other words, you see this dog and you just fall in love with it, but it's,
well,
you don't have the situation.
Yeah, a classic example is, you know, we all love border collies, or a lot of us do. They're extremely, you know, they've been ranked the smartest dog. Well, frankly, a border collie needs a job. And unfortunately, we see a lot of people get this very active, very smart dog, and it has no stimulation. And then it starts to get anxious. They're actually very sensitive a lot of times. And so then we start seeing a lot of behavior problems with them, being very fearful dogs, maybe having a lot of anxiety, separation anxiety if their person leaves them alone. So again, it might be a mismatch if you have 200 acres and a herd of sheep. Fantastic to have that border collie. But if you live in a one-room apartment and you just don't get out much, then you have a pretty bad mismatch. So we see behavior problems that can then damage the human-animal bond. And I mean, that's the joy of having pets, is to have that bond between you and your pet. And if there's always tension there, if there's always, you know, your dog's tearing up your house, or you just don't feel like you can take him for a walk and you feel guilty and all that, you'd really love to avoid that before the match was ever made.
Yeah, and I would assume that the longer that goes on, the harder it is for that dog to recuperate from that experience.
The separation anxiety thing is really interesting, because when I started practicing 30-some years ago, we didn't even know what it was, because dogs lived outside and they really kind of interacted with the family in just a little bit. Well, for better or worse, probably better, you know, dogs are very much a part of the family and are inside and are very much tied to their owner. And in some of these breeds, if they aren't stimulated enough, they don't have enough to do, their owner becomes their only thing they have in their life. And then we start seeing a lot of dogs that totally get upset when the owner leaves, and we have a lot of damage to the house and all kinds of turmoil that we'd all love to avoid to begin with.
So let me remind everyone, you are listening to Ask the Vet. This is a call-in show. The number here is 963-2976, and it is currently, 4:38. So give us a call if you have a question. It's your opportunity to get free advice. I was thinking about when those dogs get into those situations where it's not a good fit and they're really struggling, oftentimes those dogs then end up at a place like CARE or one of the other animal shelters, and we have wonderful shelters in this valley.
We do. We're very fortunate that way.
And they take really good care of the dogs, and they find really good homes for them. And we have people who really want to help these dogs, and that's a good thing. But it is harder then for those people to overcome those things, right?
Well, we were starting the conversation about puppies, so we kind of moved on to behavior and things. But the point I was trying to make is, what would be the very first thing I do? It would be just to make really sure that the puppy breed and the temperament really fits your lifestyle. And that would be step one. And then once you have made that choice with a puppy, then we hopefully can help with some of those behavior issues if we start at a very young age. So,
and what's your advice? Puppies, when we see puppies at the clinic, they come in and they're almost always really happy and licking everybody and excited, and then things happen to them in life and at the clinic. Right. So what would be your advice in terms of helping the progression?
I think the socialization is extremely important, and it's a difficult time, because on one hand you like the puppy to be exposed to a lot of different situations. For example, we even have a program where you can bring your puppy in just to get used to the vet hospital, and we take them to various rooms, and we try to expose them just to a lot of different situations. And I think that's really important.
So they don't see them as scary, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's important out in the real world, too. The kind of unfortunate thing is that those puppies are also at an age when they are most prone to getting infectious disease. So we have to kind of balance the taking them to different experiences with where are we taking them. For example, I wouldn't take your new puppy to the dog park. There's just way too many dogs of unknown origin that have been there, and they can pick up infectious disease and parasites. And likewise, they might run into a dog who is not especially well trained. So I think socializing the dog with dogs that you know in controlled situations and taking them to a lot of different situations is great, but you also have to use a lot of common sense and not take them into dangerous situations and not take them into situations where there's a lot of dogs of unknown origin, both for disease and for injury risk.
Well, and also fear, you know, if they're exposed at a young age like that to a dog that's...
Yeah, we see a lot of puppies that have a very bad experience, be it at the dog park or hopefully not at the vet so much anymore, but then I can leave a lasting impression, and then we have a lot of work to do to try and overcome that. So the early socialization period between 6 and 16 weeks is very, very important. We want to have as many positive experiences as we can, and we're emphasizing that more in the veterinary world with making the puppy visits something that's actually fun for them. Lots of positive reinforcement. We're not afraid to use whatever the puppy's attached to, be it toys or food or whatever, just to get them to feel very relaxed that this is a good place to be. And those are also the sort of things you should be looking for out in the real world, where they're going to get some positive reinforcement, where they're going to get a lot of people that are friendly to them, where they're going to get dogs who are not going to attack them. And so kind of picking where you go with your puppy is very important.
Well, and you were talking about the 6 to 16 weeks for socialization, but you also mentioned the fact that being careful about that because of infectious disease.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about that. What are the things that, we forgot to get back to kitties, but we'll do that in a minute. What are the things that you want to be avoiding with your puppy, and how do you, when and why is it okay to say, okay, now they can be around all this other?
Well, the way their immune system works, they get their primary immunity, of course, from their mother. They get a very high dose of antibodies in the mother's colostrum, which is the first milk. And so we are relying very much on mom to protect them in the early stages. Those antibody levels start to drop right after the colostrum, and so then we have to start trying to stimulate the puppy's own immune system. And that's why we start vaccinating puppies usually around 8 weeks of age to try and stimulate their own production of antibodies to protect them against these diseases. The diseases that we're always most concerned about in puppies is parvovirus. Many people who've been around dogs have heard that many, many times. Parvovirus is a often very deadly virus. Started back in the 1980s. Initially, it killed a very, very large number of dogs before there was a vaccine and people were more used to treating it. Luckily, nowadays, our vaccines are better, but we still do see it, and it's especially worrisome in that the virus can live in an infected dog's stool for 5 to 6 months. So that's one of the reasons we don't like those puppies going to the dog park, because a dog could have been there, you know, a week ago that had parvo, and your puppy could still get sick.
And that's why we want everybody to pick up their dog's droppings.
That's very true. Unfortunately, we can't pick up every single little bit, but that's very true. The other one I mentioned was distemper. Distemper virus is luckily around here, because people are so good around here, we don't see it very often. But distemper virus is a fatal disease that puppies are very prone to getting. It's a little bit interesting in that we have a reservoir in our wild animals for distemper virus, too. So raccoons, for example, it seems like every 4 to 5 years there's a big die-off of raccoons, especially up in Snowmass Village. and they test positive for having canine distemper. So it's a virus that hangs out both in our pets and in our wildlife, and so having our puppies properly protected against that is extremely important because it has even a higher fatality rate than parvovirus does.
The efficacy of these vaccines is pretty high, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it is. That's a really good point. And I think we're finally getting a little smarter with our vaccines. 30 years ago, I was taught to, use vaccines, probably overuse vaccines. And so we vaccinated even for rabies every single year. We vaccinated for distemper and parvo every single year. As the science has gotten better, these vaccines have been proven to last longer. So we don't have to vaccinate as often, which is probably a really good thing. And I think we'll probably continue to see that trend where we can probably vaccinate less. Nevertheless, I have to encourage people not to totally abandon their vaccines because part of the reason we're seeing such a reduction in all these diseases is because people have been good about vaccinating. And if we get too complacent, we're going to start seeing some of these come back. And unfortunately, in a few parts of the country, they're starting to see that.
Mm-hmm. So, Let me remind everybody, you are listening to Ask the Vet on KDNK, and it is 4:47, and this is a call-in show, so please give us a call, 963-2976. Let's talk about kitties a little bit. So talk to me about what should a cat's environment be as a very young cat? What are the things we should do to make sure we can socialize mm-hmm. our cats as well as we should, because they do kind of have a bad rap sometimes.
They do, and I happen to be kind of a cat person, so I
me too.
I don't like the bad rap they get. I actually went to a behavior seminar a few years ago, and the guy presented his own cats, and there is a very, very definite learning time for kittens between, again, somewhere around 9 to 16 weeks. And he had his cats playing whack-a-mole, batting, all kinds of things. He had them doing amazing things, and, we always think cats are...
They were probably having a ball.
They were having a blast. And so, if you think cats are not trainable, well, you're kind of right in terms of cats are independent, and they're not going to do everything just to make you happy as much, but they're very trainable and they're very smart. And so, again, that socialization.
It's all about if they're having fun, isn't it?
Yeah. And so, just as you hear a lot about people having puppy kindergarten classes, and those are great, but we probably ought to start trying to figure out a way to have kitty kindergarten classes too, because they actually can learn a lot of things. One misnomer that people often talk to me about is they think, well, how do I litter box train my cat? Well, frankly, you don't really have to. Mm-hmm. That's a very, very inherent thing in cats, is to go to the bathroom and cover it up. So if you provide it and you keep it clean and you have it in the right place, the cat will usually take care of themselves quite nicely. So, we need to stimulate our cats with things to do. We have kind of an obesity problem in the cat world. It's very similar to the human world. And cats are carnivores by nature. And if you feed them all the kibble they want, which has carbohydrates, and they never move, they have a tendency to develop type 2 diabetes just like we do. And so starting at a young age when they're a kitten, trying to get them used to playing with toys, be it a laser pointer or all the different toys they have nowadays, trying to get them at a very young age used to using a scratching post. We really, really, really don't like to declaw cats anymore. Very seldom do we ever do that. And a lot of it has to do with training. We just need to get these kittens used to using a scratching post. We need to get them used to having their nails trimmed. And if we do that, we can avoid having to do declaws, which is a really good thing.
And that's something that needs to start young, because if it doesn't start young, then it's just right. Harder to do. Not impossible.
Yeah, it can be redirected, but it for a cat to claw is a very natural thing. You're not going to change that, but you can direct that clawing to an appropriate place.
And is there something you can do to the board to make it more appealing than your couch?
Yeah, and you'll find different cats like vertical scratching posts. You'll find some cats that like the horizontal one, different textures. Sometimes you have to experiment a little bit. We use a lot of catnip on the places that we do want them to go. There's also commercial products that you can put on that attract the cats. Likewise, if you have a place that is inappropriate for the cat, you need to make that place unappealing.
Unappealing, yeah.
So you can use, some people will use aluminum foil, for example. They don't like the feel of that.
That's a great suggestion.
Just trying to figure out something that won't hurt the cat, but that's going to be unappealing.
Really unappealing.
Yeah. So you know, those are the sort of things you can talk with your veterinarian about, and you can talk with a behavior person about all kinds of little tricks. Our goal is to, give these animals stimulation, give them something that they love doing, and, declawing has become almost a absolute last resort. There's even places that have banned declawing, and we rarely ever do it, only in extreme cases. And the way to avoid that is just to start with the proper training at a young age.
So I have a question from the outside.
Okay.
So how finicky are cats about their litter box?
Very. I think we get away with probably more than we should. The litter boxes really need to be scooped absolutely every day. And I'm amazed that cats put up with what they do sometimes. And some of them don't. I know my cats, we had one that if you missed a day, she'd let you know. She would go right outside the box, and we call that litter box aversion.
Well, at least she didn't pick your shoe
Yeah, I guess we were lucky that way. But no, litter box care is really important, and that's one of those things when we're seeing young kittens we need to talk about. There's kind of a basic rule is you should have one litter box plus one for each cat you have. So if you have two cats in the house, you should have at least three litter boxes. So, and then placement of litter boxes is extremely important. Unfortunately, sometimes people will put them just where it's convenient for them, but if it's next to your very loud washer and your cat's scared of the washer, you're probably going to have a problem.
Yeah.
Likewise, you want to keep them out of traffic areas, high traffic areas. Cats want to be secluded, just like we tend to like to be secluded when we go to the bathroom.
Yeah, shut the door, please.
Exactly. So a lot of good common sense things, but I think litter box care will pay off many times over if you do it right. You're much less likely to have cats urinating around the house where you don't want them to. So,
because we don't have a whole lot of time left, so let's talk about, we talked a lot about actually behavior and socialization, which is good. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the socialization and the connection to infection and the need for vaccines for cats as well.
So in kitty cats, there's two kind of core groups of vaccines. Kitty cats also are vaccinated for a virus that's similar to parvo called panleukopenia, and they're vaccinated for respiratory diseases. Probably the number one that's seen is a herpes virus. And so we need to vaccinate them for those. If they have any contact with other cats, we should be thinking about feline leukemia. And then both cats and dogs, we need to make sure they're vaccinated for rabies, because that is a public health issue for both cats, dogs, and humans.
And humans. Anything else humans as well?
Not so much. And there's some rare cases of, you can get something like ringworm from your cat, which is not a worm. That's a fungus. So I've seen that a fair amount. Most of the really serious diseases are fairly species specific, but rabies is the one that nobody messes around with. And unfortunately, rabies has really had a big uptick in Colorado. So far, it's stayed on the Front Range, but we're
because it can also be in wild animals
as well, right?
So we can't control that.
You know, in many parts of the country, skunks are the big reservoir for it. Other places, it's coyotes. Other places, it's foxes. In eastern slope of Colorado, it's mostly skunk rabies. And, of course, we all know how skunks can make their way into places where your dog could easily have contact with them. So keeping your animals up to date on rabies is not just good for your pet. It's a public health thing.
All right. I think we're wrapping it up. Thanks, everyone who's able to listen to us. And we'll see you next month, third Thursday, 4:30. Thanks. Bye.